This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Vanishing Year by Kate Moretti. Read by Madeline Mabee. The Vanishing Year. Chapter 1. April 2014, New York City. Lately, I've been dreaming about my mother. Not Evelyn, the only mother I've ever known, the woman who raised me and loved me and taught me to swim in the fresh water of Lake Chabot, bake a sticky sweet pecan pie, fly fish. I've thought about Evelyn plenty in the 5 years since she died. I'd venture to say, every day. My dreams lately are filled with the mother I've never met. I imagine her at 16 years, leaving me in the care of the neonatal nurses. Did she kiss my forehead, study her baby's small, wrinkled fingers? Or did she just scurry out as fast as she could, hugging the wall, ducking the shadows to avoid detection until she burst through the doors into the night air where she could breathe again? I could have been born in a bathroom stall at the junior prom, or in the back of her parents' car. I prefer to imagine her as a scared young kid. The only thing I know about her at all is her name, Carolyn Seaver. And that is likely a fake. My dreams are disjointed, filled with bright colors and blinking lights. Sometimes Carolyn is saving me from a faceless killer, and sometimes she is the faceless killer, chasing me with knives up winding staircases that never seem to end. Even when I'm awake, chopping vegetables for a salad for lunch, or taking notes for a board meeting, I'll drift off, lost in a daydream about what she might be doing right now, or if we have the same dark, fickle hair or the same handwriting. Wonder what quirks, biologically, I've inherited from someone I've never met, and sometimes I'll come to in the middle of the kitchen wielding a large butcher knife, the lettuce limping on the counter. I've killed quite a bit of time this way. I wonder if she'd be proud of the woman I've become. The benefit for CARE, Children's Association for Relief and Education, starts in an hour. I pace back and forth in the bedroom. I've never chaired before, and I can't afford to be distracted. Yet here I am, my brain run amok when I can least afford it.
Relax, Zoe. You've done a fabulous job, I'm sure. Like always.
Henry approaches me from behind. His large hands dance over my clavicle as he fastens the clasp of a single strand of freshwater pearls around my neck. I close my eyes and relax back into his lean frame, all sinewy muscle despite his 40 years. He kisses my bare right shoulder and runs a hand down my side. His palm is hot against the fitted silk of my gown, and I turn to kiss him. I step back and admire his tuxedo. His slick blonde hair and angular jaw give him an air of power. Or maybe it's just the way he appraises people, even me. He is studying me, his head cocked to the side. What?
I think the single diamond would look stunning with that dress, he suggests softly, and I pause.
He crosses the bedroom and opens the safe, retrieving one of many velvet cases, and I watch him deftly remove a thin, sparkling chain, return the box to the safe, and give the dial a clockwise spin. I love the curve of his neck as he examines the necklace, the small dip behind his ear and the slope of his hairline. His hair curled slightly at the nape, and I want to run my nails up the back of his scalp. I love the long lines of his body, and I imagine his spine beneath the layers of thick fabric, all hard-edged dips and valleys. I love his almost invisible smirk, teasing me as he motions me to spin around. I comply, and in one swift motion he removes the pearls and clasps the solitaire. I turn and gaze into the mirror, and a small part of me agrees. The solitaire looks fantastic. It is large, 5 carats, and it rests above the wide band of the strapless dress, the bottom of the teardrop hinting seductively at an ample swell of cleavage. As always, I am divided with Henry. I love his authority, the strength he has that his opinions are not merely suggestions. Or maybe it's just that he's so different from me. Decisive, definitive. But I did love the pearls. Seems indecent somehow for a benefit, doesn't it? I am tracing the outline of the diamond, watching him in the mirror. His eyes flicker over my reflected body. The size of the diamond, I clarify. He shakes his head slowly.
I don't think so. It's a benefit for children, yes, but only the wealthy attend these sorts of things. You know this. It's as much a display of the organizer as anything else. Everyone will be watching you.
He rests his hands on my shoulders. Stop! You're making me nervous! I am already on edge, my mind swimming with details. I've done a few of these kinds of events as a second chair, but never as a chairperson. There will be a large crowd, all eyes on me, and my heart flutters against my ribcage at the thought. I've been in Henry's world more than a year now, and the need to prove myself seems never abating. This will be the first time I've taken any of the spotlight for myself. My debutante ball, if you will. And yet, I'm completely foolish. I'm risking everything for a slice of validation. These are things I can't say to Henry, or to anyone. His palms are cool and heavy. We stand this way for an indefinite amount of time, our eyes connected in the mirror. As usual, I can't tell what he's thinking. I have no idea if he is happy or pleased, or what he feels beyond anything he says. His eyes are veiled and closed, his mouth bowed down in a slight frown. He kisses my neck and I close my eyes.
You are beautiful, he whispers,
and for a moment his cheekbones soften, his eyes widen slightly, the tautness of his mouth, his chin seems to loosen. His face opens up to me and I can read him. I wonder how many other women say this, that their husbands befuddle them. Most of the time, Henry is a closed book, his face a smooth plane, his bedroom face similar to his boardroom face, and I'm left to puzzle him out, to tease the meaning from carefully guarded responses. But right now, he looks at me expectantly. I was thinking about Carolyn. I wince, knowing this isn't the right time. I want to pull the words back. He gives me a small smile.
We can talk later. Let's just have a nice time, please.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out his cell phone. He strides out of the room, and my back is cold, missing the heat of him. My shoulders feel lighter, and when I glance back to the mirror, my mouth is open as if to call him back. It's not that he objects to my finding Carolyn, necessarily. He's just impatient with the recent obsession. He doesn't think these things ever end well, and he is the kind of man who respects the current state of affairs. He may have used those words. He can't understand the need.
You have me, he says when I bring it up. You have us, our life, the way it is now. She rejected you.
I think he takes it personally. We have been married nearly a year and have the rest of our lives to complicate things. I think about couples who giggle and share their pasts, their childhood memories and lost loves. Henry thinks all these conversations are unnecessary, trivial. He is the kind of person whose life travels a straight path, his head filled with to-do lists and goals. Meandering is for slackers and dreamers. And certainly, mulling over the what has been is a fruitless effort. You can't change the past. I admitted once to having a journal in college, a place to keep scraps of poetry, quotes I'd picked up along the way, slices of life. Henry cocked his head, his eyebrows furrowed, the whole idea unfathomable. And yet, here I am. This house, this man, this life, it's mine. despite the insecurities that seem to follow me around like a stray cat. I stare at my reflection. A thin pink scar zigzags horizontally across the top of my right wrist as I touch the diamond at my throat, the setting big as a strawberry. His sure footsteps beat against the teak floor of the apartment, and his deep baritone echoes as he calls for the car. Time to leave. I've always been attracted to elegance, and I blame Evelyn's fascination with money. It's so easy to be consumed by it when you have none. But unlike Evelyn, I don't look for the glossy, airbrushed facade of celebrity, the flash of comfortable entitlement. I prefer the tiny details, clean lines and sleek design. I care about whether California rolls are passé or if the gift bags properly reflect a theme. I love when bright, spiky dahlias are arranged with classic white lilies, a contrast of classic and fun, and the resulting graceful style elicits a quiet gasp of, "You know, I rarely notice the centerpieces, but this is exquisite." I muse over minutia, the table linen color. Will it match the butter-yellow stamen that shoots from the center of the lily? The wine, the main course, lamb is such an acquired taste. Designing, whether it be a floral arrangement or decor for a benefit, is where I feel at home. It's where I feel like me, whoever I am at the moment. It's been the only constant. The New York Public Library steps are lit with hundreds of flameless candles that flicker by design, with no regard to the wind. The white marble of Astor Hall is awash with deep blue lighting. Large light installations reminiscent of bare budding trees are intermingled with 6-foot-tall columns wound with bursting white and green lilies. White lights twinkle on almost every flat surface. The tables are spotlighted in soft blue and green lights. It's an enchanted forest, complete with hanging crystal butterflies. Metamorphosis. How apt. Henry places his hand on the small of my back and leans down to my ear. "Zoe, this looks incredible." His breath smells sweet like spun sugar. "You were right. Is that what you're looking for?" I tease. Henry had suggested the NYPL for the venue in the first place. The rotunda looks better than I could have imagined, better than my silly sketches. I turn in place, absorbing the details, the elegance I desire so much. The 6-person tables perfect for intimate conversation, the crystal centerpieces that mimic the trees, white reaching branches thrust toward the ceiling, balancing a smattering of glass-winged butterflies. Each table is adorned with greens, small woody bundles nestled inside frosted mason jars and blooming baby lilies. The overall effect is of being thrust into an enchanted forest, minus the wood sprites. Everything glittery white and green, glass sparkling. I think to call Lydia. The flowers look amazing. Le Fleur-de-Lis did the event as a favor to me, although my conversations with Lydia had been all business. A familiar pang of loss hits me. The walls are tastefully hung with information on care, black and white photos of past events, less elegant but more real, as the wealthy often claim to want to be real, a concept that has always made me laugh. People claim to want authenticity. Another word that is bandied about at these events, yet men like Norman Crable, on the shortlist of the richest men of New York, are never seen on the new playgrounds or at any orphan shelter outside of the ribbon cutting. I try very hard not to let this bother me. But yet, the black and whites hang, real and authentic, with wide-open smiles of parentless children, black and white, Asian and Indian, Portuguese and Spanish. Children who don't understand racism or hate, only the cool rejection of a foster family's dismissal. Some of them I know by name, but not all. And at that juncture, I have to wonder if I'm any better than the Norman Crables of the world. "Zoe, I think everything has come together beautifully." Francesca Martin is walking briskly toward me, her heels clipping against the marble floor. "One thing, we had chosen white linens. But here, look. She leads me to a table in the corner, and the white is stark, blinding and rough in the blue lighting. The table next to it absorbs the blue effortlessly, the lights softened somehow by the linen, but I can't make out the color. It's a lavender linen. I know, she holds up her hand and shakes her head. Lavender is outdated. Believe me, I know. It's like 3 springs ago, and I honestly have no idea if it's ever coming back, but I think with the blue lighting, the white is just too much. You can't even tell it's lavender. It's so offset by the green and blue. It's so late for a last-minute change. I'm skeptical, but Francesca isn't the event coordinator at NYPL without reason. Her instincts are sharp, impeccable. I agree, and one of Francesca's hired hands changes linens. The brightness of the room softens to a deep, rich glow. The benefit is a relatively small one, only 200 people. It's not a formal sit-down dinner, but a simple cocktail hour, with a rotating array of hors d'oeuvres all chosen to reflect the Enchanted Forest theme of the party. Wild mushroom ragout, spring pea puree on crostini, diver scallops with foie gras butter, bison tartare. The standing tables in the corner hold silver trays lined with Stilton pastries and raspberry chutney, strawberry ricotta tartlets with apple blossom honey. My mouth waters, but my stomach flips in nervous protest.
Simply stunning, darling.
Henry hovers next to the 3-piece orchestra, a flute of champagne in each hand. He hands one to me and gives me one of his rare but dazzling smiles. Proud. At this moment, he is proud. The evening turns with unstoppable speed. I am shuttled from one table to the next, a conveyor belt for mingling. I stay mostly quiet, nod and smile. I recognize a few people, but Henry knows everyone, his arm snaked protectively around my waist. It's my event, yet somehow Henry still runs the show. I'm appraised always, the unasked question, why, hovering on everyone's lips. With every charm, every joke, every time the crowd rumbles with laughter at my husband, the women, especially the women, look at me, heads slightly cocked, a small flick of their eyes. Barely noticeable. Why you? The question is never verbalized. Now that I've assimilated, the men are more accepting. Tonight, they're stunning in dark tuxedos, their faces clean-shaven and shiny, their dates breathtaking in long, draping gowns, their designers referred to only as Carolina, Vera, Donna, and Oscar. My own strapless gown, blue and adorned with white crystals, was bought off the rack at Bergdorf's. I swing wildly between my independence and my desire to be preened by Henry. His power and his money and his affection. He pretends not to notice, and I pretend I'm not in over my head here in this world. At the moment, we both find this silent agreement charming. A reporter from the New York Post circulates, as I've invited him but requested that he not make a nuisance of himself. His ticket was a gift, much to the protest of the Board of Care. But in return, I've asked for a front-page spread in the society pages. I am hoping for above the fold. I'm told that it will depend on Norman Crable's appearance. The reporter, whose name I've forgotten, has strict instructions. Photograph the event, the guests, the decor. Do not, under any circumstances, photograph me. He laughed at that, mistakenly believing my adamancy derived from a woman's insecurity, and I waved off his protests with a light flick of my hand. He spends the evening quietly snapping photographs, and I can't be certain, but I feel as though the camera is frequently aimed at me. I skim the shadows, avoid the spotlight, but too often I catch the reporter's eye. He seems to be one of these men who wants to rescue a woman, a she doesn't know she's beautiful man, like he could be the one to show me. The whole idea is silly. Skirting the spotlight has become a way of life, and not all that long ago, a necessity. maybe even still a necessity. But I avoid thinking about it. Past donors and board members rotate on the podium. I've talked my co-chair into being the MC. Public speaking is not my thing. The closing speaker is Amanda Natiz, a 20-year-old culinary student who was raised primarily on the money provided by CARE. She is a success story, we hope a harbinger of things to come. We'd like more stories like hers. When Amanda was 18, she aged out of the system and was handed $4,000 courtesy of CARE. She's worked nights as a dishwasher and apprentice in various chain restaurants, and recently she enrolled in culinary school. Her speech is met with a standing ovation. The reporter is snapping madly. It doesn't hurt that Amanda is a stunning 6-foot-tall black woman born with a grace the system was unable to take from her. I greet her off stage in the darkened wing and give her a hug. Up close, she is teary, and I feel the edge seep away. This matters. I repeat it like a mantra. It's the best I can do. I seek Henry. In public, I always seek Henry. I can't help it. He is only moderately tall, but his glossy hair is a beacon. In a crowd, he is charming, erudite. His comments are thoughtful, and he is well-versed in current events and politics. His opinions are generally heavily considered and almost never debated. Something about the tone of his voice, floating above the din of the crowd. I find him in a circle, men nodding along with him as he waxes about tax benefits. A redhead leans toward him, whispering in his ear, and he laughs. When he sees me, he reaches back, pulls me into the circle against his side, between him and the redhead, and she gives me a sly smile. There's that why. She relocates to his left, continues to lean toward him. She whispers clever commentary out of the side of her mouth, words I can't make out, bits of gossip I don't understand. She and Henry know the same people. I absently tend to a wayward strand of lights. Eventually, she wanders away. Norman Crable shows up late, a blonde on his arm who is not Mrs. Crable, and the crowd buzzes with the slight whiff of scandal. As I catch the Post reporter's eye, he gives me a small wink. Above the fold, it's all I'm asking for here. He nods once, the blonde cementing the spot. And I sigh with relief. The charity has never been featured in the society section, but my goal this year was to bring it up to the celebrity level. Not for the glitz and the glamour of it. That's more of a liability than anything to me. But for the fact I am deeply attached to the cause of helping adopted and orphaned children. Then again, I am one.
Silly man, Henry murmurs from behind me.
Henry knows Norman, and he's always been fairly vocal about his impatience with adulterers. It's easy for Henry to chide, as his wife is not yet 30 years old. I remind him of this as a private joke, and he tells me what he always tells me. I will love you when you're 90. The buzz dies down, and later I hear that Norman's blonde is lovely to look at, but dumb as a stone. Henry almost laughs at this, but not quite. The soft laugh lines around his mouth deepen, and he gives a muffled harumph. The evening is ending. The number of guests leaving tipsy and laughing is a sign of success, I think. I have spoken with 90% of the people there, and I am worn. Tired, I lean against Henry's shoulder.
"I'm sorry, but we've been watching you all night, and I have to ask," says a voice from behind me.
I turn and stare. The woman continues as though my face has not drained of all color.
"But you're Hillary Lawler, aren't you?" "You are. We'd know you anywhere."
The woman is round and soft and friendly, and her husband is almost a mirror image of her. Two weebles standing side by side. I concentrate on breathing, but I'd know them anywhere. Their happy laughter, their identical snub noses, hers freckled, his not, her round, bright blue eyes framed with black, spidery lashes. She's gained about 20 pounds in the past 5 years, and, not surprisingly, so has her husband. I am hot and cold at once. My head is buzzing. I'm overly aware of Henry's arm brushing mine, and I sense him straighten up, take interest. I'm sorry, you must have the wrong person. My name is Zoe Whittaker. I turn and grasp Henry's arm too hard. Henry says nothing but wrinkles his brow, my back turned to the couple. In 5 years, this has happened only one other time. One other incident of being discovered, of being found out. And it amounted to nothing. I saw an old college professor in a restaurant and tried to duck out before she could recognize me. I saw the dawning comprehension in her eyes, a slight turn of her head, her mouth opening to speak. I paid the bill and left. It amounted to nothing, as I am sure this will too. Yet I find that I can't catch my breath.
Hillary, I can't believe this. Do you know everyone thinks you're dead?
Her voice is shrill, and she's excited, inching around to face me again. I realize she's not going to let it go. Who would? I stare at a large, pink, cubic zirconia pendant wobbling in her ample cleavage. A bead of sweat glistens there. She's about to hug me, I can tell. I want to tell her Hillary is dead, you see? But I can't. I open and close my mouth, and then, because I don't know what else to do, I cover my lips with my hand and murmur to Henry, I've had too much champagne, I think. I feel sick. Quickly, he grabs my elbow and leads me outside. The air is crisp, the way an April night should be, and the wind slaps my cheeks, bringing some of the blood back. I don't know when Henry called the car, but it idles out front and we rush into it, a tumble of silk swooshing against the leather seats. After we pile in, he pinches my chin, turns my head to him, studies me. I involuntarily jerk my head away. He asks,
"Are you okay? Are you going to faint?"
I shake my head no. We are quiet while I put the pieces together, and I realize it's a bit amazing it's only happened twice. I mean, I went to college in California, but it's not the other side of the world. This is New York, the city of millions of transplants a year. I take deep, calming breaths and hope that tonight she will not call her girlfriends, her old sorority sisters. You will not believe who I saw tonight. No one will believe her. It's too crazy.
That was the oddest thing, Henry says, looking out the window, his fingers absently tracing circles on the back of my hand. They thought you were someone else. Hannah something?
I know. I have no idea who she was. I laugh, but it sounds forced. I must have drunk a ton of champagne.
But did you know them?
Henry watches me now, his eyes narrowed. It's not like Henry to press an issue. He's generally too dismissive for that. His sharp, eagle eyes are fastened now on the idea, a field mouse in his sights. I pause, weighing my options. I stare out the window at the receding steps of the library, and I can see them at the top, watching us, their mouths agape, and the man shaking his head, pointing with a thick index finger at the car as it pulls away. They must have followed us out. I have no options. I still protect my secret as though my life depends on it. No, I didn't. But I'm lying. Molly McKay was my roommate in college. 5 years ago, in the throes of finals week, I left our small one-bedroom apartment on Willard Street in the middle of the night and never came back.
Chapter 2. I wake on Saturday, sweating and panicked, with the vague notions of a terrifying dream tugging at my mind. Before it seeps away, I can only grasp large shadows and men with guns chasing me down 42nd Street. I sit up, untangling my legs from damp sheets. The room has the eerie cast of early morning rain, bluish and depressing. Henry is gone, and that itself isn't unusual. He's usually up before 5 and out the door, even on a Saturday. Sundays are for sleeping in and espresso in the sitting room, but Saturdays are just another work day. The night before comes back to me in a rush, followed by a heavy clenching feeling in my stomach.
I swing my legs over the side of the bed, and for a second, my vision clouds as the world shifts sideways. I push the heel of my hand into my forehead. I didn't drink but one glass of champagne. The pulsing behind my eyes can't be a hangover. I have a nebulous memory of Henry pressing a small white tablet into my palm the night before, kissing my forehead.
"Tonight, you'll take this," he said,
and I felt a quick flash of irritation. But I swallowed it down on instinct, the need to sleep and to forget Molly McKay. I hadn't protested, but quite honestly, I don't understand his penchant for pills, his fussing, trying to push this or that, a medication, a tablet, a drug. There's always something to cure any ailment, and the bottles sit lined up in Henry's medicine cabinet like soldiers waiting to battle the bulk of his ails. Alprazolam, Zolpidem, Lorazepam. The thick, cottony coating of my tongue confirms it. Henry, unaware of my past or my reasons, always pushes aside my protests with a dismissive pat. The shower is hot. The spray rinses away the remaining fog from whatever I'd been given. As I dry off and tie the towel around me, tucking one end into the other, I shake loose any resentment. He's only trying to help. Henry babies me, and I waffle between secretly adoring it, the pampering and the idea of being this kept woman, and childishly rejecting it, rebelling like a teenager to his silly rules and requests. Henry is a product of a traditional household, and paternalism runs deep in his veins, which I find both charming and a little infuriating depending on the day. I check the clock. 8:58. I want to call Francesca to find out exactly how I missed Molly McKay's name on the final guest list. Of course, she married her boyfriend, but his last name escapes me entirely. Then it clicks, like tumblers sliding into place. Gunther. Her boyfriend, now her husband, I was sure, his name was Gunther. Well, if I had seen Molly and Gunther on the guest list, I would have been on alert. I am used to watching my back this way. I've spent half of the last decade with a careful eye on the street behind me. Although, to be honest, since marrying Henry, I've become increasingly sloppier about it. In our Tribeca penthouse, it is hard not to feel protected, insulated from evil, as though having money keeps you good or wholesome. I'm not naive. In many cases, aren't the rich the ones perpetuating evil? I remember Molly from our college days, round and bubbly with peering, hawk-like blue eyes. Even then, she'd fasten on to an idea. A boy one of us liked, a professor we hated, a piece of wayward gossip. And figure out how it could benefit her, turn it razor sharp. She was subtle in her manipulation even then, and age and time hone natural skills. She was someone to fear if she knew your secrets. I envision her now working her pet Gunther into a full frenzy. We'd always called him that, meanly, behind their backs. Her trick dog. The phone shrills, and I'm startled out of this thought. The clock reads exactly 9, and I smile. Henry calls at exactly 9 every day, never a minute later or a minute earlier. I asked him once, what if he was in a meeting? Surely this could happen. At the time, he had only blinked at me and replied,
I can miss a few minutes of any meeting, regardless of the topic.
And his answer was so definitive I never questioned it again. At least, not out loud. It still strikes me every single day as odd. Who can say that they can carve out time, no matter the length, at exactly the same time every day without fail? Hello? I half sigh and half laugh into the phone.
Are you still sick?
His voice comes over the line, silky and deep like melted chocolate. No, I feel better. With enough sleep, I guess anyone would. I say this sarcastically, but with a smile in my voice. Henry laughs softly.
Can't you ever just let me take care of you? I love to, you know. And you said you do feel better.
I say nothing because, quite honestly, I do. When I'm quiet, he continues.
Okay, I'm sorry. I know you hate the sleeping pills. I try very hard not to recommend them. Am I forgiven? Meet me for lunch?
Maybe. I have some odds and ends to tie up from last night. Can I let you know? I trace the pattern of the coverlet with my fingertip, a manicured red fingernail on the bright white spread like a blood spatter. I pull the towel tighter around me. He harumphs on the line, I can tell. I rarely say no to Henry.
You will eat, right? You'll eat, regardless. Why not join me?
We'll see, okay? I'll call you. Don't worry. I love you. We hang up, and before I can second-guess myself, I call Francesca and request the final guest list. In 30 seconds, my email bings. I tap it open on my phone and scan it. It looks the same as it did the previous Wednesday. No mention of Molly McKay or Gunther what's-his-name. I call Francesca back and ask her if there is a way someone could have attended the benefit without being on the guest list. She is flippant. Sure, I think some sets of tickets were purchased as comps from corporations. That's pretty common, an out-of-town colleague, the boss wants to show him a nice event, see how swanky New York can be. Benefit events are used as networking opportunities all the time. Why? I say no reason, and we hang up. I log onto the computer with my phone still in my hand. I Google Gunther and the University of California, San Francisco, and the first hit has a picture. Gunther Rowe. The picture is dated this year. His face is sloped into his neck and his smile is wide, too ingenuous for a man approaching 30. His teeth are gapped and the overall effect is cartoonish. He looks slightly older than my memories of him, a bit more rotund, but there's no doubting who he is. A few more Google searches reveal Gunther and Molly were married a few years ago, a lavish West Coast wine country wedding. A few more searches, including Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, reveal Gunther is currently living in Mobile, Alabama, as a pharmaceutical sales representative for Gencor Pharmaceuticals. Another quick search shows me the home office of Gencor is on Lexington Avenue here in Manhattan. I puff out a breath. Okay, that mystery is probably solved. I contemplate calling Francesca back to confirm, but between my hasty exit last night and the phone call this morning, she probably thinks I've lost my mind. I feel irrationally stuck, claustrophobic. What if Molly and Gunther figure out who I am? It wouldn't be difficult, really. I've become shamefully carefree. I imagine them staking out my apartment, possibly chatting easily with Walter, the doorman. How long have you known Zoe Whittaker? I put my head between my knees and take a few deep, calming breaths. I'm thinking of the pictures. God, I was so stupid. I want to bring care up a notch. I said that. What was I thinking? What if my face ends up in the newspaper? It wouldn't be the first time. Shortly after I came to New York, I was part of a feature that appeared in New York Magazine for the flower shop where I worked, Le Fleur de Lis. I was a grunt, an intern. They stuck me in the corner of a group photo shoot, no matter that I tried to wriggle out of it altogether. I repeatedly turned my head at the last moment until the photographer, exasperated, finally proclaimed he'd gotten a good one. Elisa had looked at me, rolled her eyes like she'd known I was the problem. When the feature ran, I sweat bullets for a month. But my face, my stupid, stretchy, involuntary grin, was there, as recognizable as anything. Nothing happened. I press my fist between my teeth. I've always had a problem with listening, even as a child. I was stubborn. Hillary will do what Hillary will do, a common sing-song refrain from Evelyn. Her round, cherubic face, healthy and flush with color, tilted up, her mouth open, her finger wagging in front of my nose. I remember something and fish through my purse. Pulling out a slip of paper, I dial the number scrawled on the back in my own hand. When the receptionist picks up and chirps, "New York Post," I ask for Cash Murray. His voice comes on the line after a small blip of hold music, and I ask him to meet me for coffee. He agrees and picks a place a block from the office. I dress conservatively, in a white silk blouse and black pants, and I'm at the coffee shop 10 minutes early. To my surprise, Cash is already there, seated in a corner booth, thumbing through the New York Times.
"Do you have to hide out in obscure diners to read that?" I say as I slide into the booth across from him. My pant leg catches on a ripped swath of red vinyl. I look down quickly and am relieved to see the fabric isn't torn. He gives me a grin, and I realize he's much younger than I'd thought. He's my age. A beefy man, the kind that spends an hour in the gym every day. But probably not more than that. A simple effort to fight off genetics. His elbows rest on the table and his arms are thick, his nails bitten to the quick. He moves quickly, the jumpy, alert markers of a journalist.
"To what do I owe the honor, Mrs. Whittaker?"
He sips from his mug, raising one eyebrow. I flush, feeling transparent. "I need you to show me your pictures from last night." I end the statement with an upward lilt and silently curse myself. I think of Henry, who speaks with gusto, who would have thrown off the statement like a command and Cash would be scrambling to meet it. I get raised eyebrows and a friendly smile.
"Oh, yeah, I got some really great shots."
He's enthusiastic now, leaning back in his seat.
"I'd love to run them by you. You know, you're easy to photograph."
He picks at his nail. "Well, that's what I wanted to tell you. I need you to not run any shots of me in particular." I try for my Henry voice. "I did discuss that before the event, you know."
"Oh, that's almost impossible. I mean, you ran the show. The whole event was spectacular, and you were the shining star of the night. Really, if you're worried about the shots, I'm telling you, they were stunning. I say that professionally, you know?"
"No, Mr. Murray, listen, it's not that. I just can't have my picture in the paper, okay? I won't sign off on it."
"Well, to be honest, you don't have to. I was invited to the event to take pictures. If you want me to run the article, I need to use you. Frankly, photos of impoverished kids aren't selling the society pages. Beautiful women who care about impoverished kids are."
"Then don't run the article."
"But I already wrote it."
"I don't care. Can't you just call the whole thing off?" He eyes me suspiciously and I shift in my seat. I maintain eye contact, refusing to be the one who breaks first. Finally, he gives me a wry smile.
"Why don't I show you what I have and we can go from there?"
I nod slowly. "Okay, fine."
"But my camera is at home. How about we meet here Monday, same time?"
"When is the article running?" I'm surprised. I'd expected it to run tomorrow.
"Oh, well, it's a write-up of the event, but it's more a spotlight of the charity, so it'll run next Sunday."
I agree to meet him, then almost laugh out loud at a sudden thought. The reason behind my insistence is a better story than the one he's trying to protect. I realize then why Cash Murray is a journalist for the society pages. He lacks the nose for hard news. I pull out my cell phone and call Henry.
"Zoe, I had a feeling you'd change your mind. I was headed to Gramercy Tavern. Join me."
By the time I get there, he is already seated. He has chosen a table in the center of the room with an eye on the door where he can view the comings and goings. He wears a casual Saturday dress shirt with pressed khakis and he flashes me a genuine smile. My heart catches.
"Sit, sweetheart. I've ordered you wine. How did you spend your morning?"
He eyes me keenly over his menu. He means to look nonchalant, but how I spend my time is always of utmost interest to him. Sometimes this irritates me. Today, I do something I've never done before. I omit. "Oh, I spoke with Francesca about last night." A technical truth.
"Ah, and she was thrilled, I imagine."
Henry studies the first courses. I don't know why he bothers. He'll order beef tartare with a single glass of Barolo. "Completely thrilled. Thanks for all your help. Last night, the past few weeks." Henry had been publicly supportive of the benefit, talking it up in conversations with colleagues and giving statements to the media.
Above the menu, I can see his eyes crinkled at the corners. He looks older, somehow, than he did even last night.
Why wouldn't I? What matters to you matters to me. Is that so hard to believe?
He folds the menu and looks at me intently. This is his thing, this intense, you're the only one in the room gaze. Everyone from investors to servicemen are equally charmed by Henry Whittaker, which is mostly why he can order a bottle-only wine by the glass. Henry motions to someone across the room, and through the rest of lunch I sit silently while Henry discusses business, market dips and trades, with anyone who stops by our table. He makes attempts to include me, blathers on about last night, calls me brilliant to his friends. He receives polite nods in return. They're used to his posturing when it comes to me. I stay for an hour, enough time to placate him, and then excuse myself. I kiss his cheek and walk myself out. In the afternoon, I nap. Later, I wander the penthouse as dusk settles, enveloping the apartment in darkness, almost without my realizing it, until suddenly I can barely see. I wander to the great room and flick on a single lamp. I love our home. You can see every inch of Manhattan, I swear. I've spent cumulative hours staring out the windows in each room, down to the street below where the cars look like toys and the people scurry by busy as mice. The building is a converted textile warehouse. Pre-war, Henry drops in casual conversation. People seem impressed by this. The floors are deep cherry and the moldings are ornately carved. Everything is heavy and big. Big. Decorated by a man. 20-foot ceilings and elaborate archways give way to sleek furnishings with simple lines. The contrast is a designer's dream, and when I first moved in, I explored every corner, ran my fingertips against every brocade-carved mantle, every marble surface. The whole place looked dipped in shellac. I asked Henry once if I could redecorate it, maybe add some light floral touches. He gave me a funny look.
Oh, but Penny does the decorating.
Penny, Henry's right-hand woman, housekeeper, cook, life organizer, home decorator, retriever of lost keys and wallets, and finder of obscure late-century credenzas. She's in her 60s, I think, but looks older, weathered like she'd sat too long in the sun, browned like a raisin. I felt stung at the time. I majored in design in college, although I couldn't tell him that then. I wonder if I can tell him that now. I open my book. I wait for Henry to come home. Chapter 3. June 2009, San Pablo, California. The bar smelled like old men. The kind of permanent sweat stain that leaches into everything, the unfinished wood grain of the chairs, the thick ancient varnish of the bar top, the heavy brocade drapes. The air felt hot, wet, like maybe the air conditioner had been on and now it was condensing on every flat surface in the heat wave. Even the neon bar signs had given up, flickering on and off half-heartedly. Max's Cocktail Lounge. The name conjured up some kind of 1940s velvet-lined Art Deco salon, but the reality was shrouded in wood paneling. I sat at the end of the bar, the beginning of a nightly ritual that started with vodka tonics and ended with whiskey. I had no place to go. Except this place. I heard him before I saw him.
Well, if it isn't little Hillary, who ain't so little.
The voice cut through the smoke and the booze and gave me a chill. He stood next to me, his fingertips dancing across the back of my bar stool, and all I could think was, "Don't you dare touch me." The anger filled my throat. Nick. I faced him, and he seemed surprised. His blonde hair flopped in front of his green eyes. His face was tanned, lined, but in a broken, weathered way that made women want to fix him. One woman in particular. She's dead, but thanks for stopping by.
I watched his reaction through slitted eyes, and he was appropriately surprised, then sad.
Ah, I'm sorry, Peach. I knew she was sick.
But you didn't come?
Your mama and I loved her, but we just aren't the same kind of people.
He made a coughing sound which almost sounded like a sob. For a second, I looked up. His eyes were dry. I don't know what that means.
It's easy, sugar. She's a good person.
Was. I pushed my glass away, the liquor sliding up over the lip and onto the bar top.
What's that?
She was a good person. She's dead now. She's actually in the county coroner's office because I, her daughter, and possibly the only person who truly cared about her, can't afford to bury her. He sat on the bar stool next to me, his palms flat on the wood in front of him.
When?
His voice was soft, the swagger kicked out, and his grief coming too late. A week ago? Sunday?
Your mama had a million friends, H. Everyone loved her. She was a spirit, you know?
He said this to me like I didn't know, and I wanted to kick his shins with both feet hard. I pictured that, the toe of my high heel making small, pointed, bluish-green marks, like the ones he'd left on Evelyn's arms, dotting his flesh like tiny fingerprints. The truth was, she used to have friends. Before Mick. Before cancer. Yeah? Well, where are they? I pulled the corner of my napkin back, pressing the pad of my finger into the puddle of whiskey and touching it to my tongue.
I don't know. I have some phone numbers. We could call some people. Get help.
Why don't you help? She loved you, you know? He looked pained.
I was never good enough, that's all, Hillary. I'm sorry about Evelyn. I'm sorry about everything.
I waved my hand. It didn't matter. Mick had been in and out of our lives so much he'd hardly been a stabilizer. I hadn't seen him in more than 6 months. Just enough time for Evelyn to get sick. Really sick. For the cancer to come back with a vengeance and for her to die. Alone.
I can help you. I can get money. What do you need?
$3,000?
That's not a whole lot.
He rubbed his jaw, his 3-day stubble flecked with new gray.
Can I give you a ride home?
Just go away, Mick. I rested my forehead on the back of my hand, which cupped the top of my glass. Everything felt so heavy. When I looked up, he was gone. The days had started to blend into each other. I ignored my phone, which rang incessantly with professors and friends, people I'd blown off when I left that night. When the call came from the care nurse, "Come home now, Evelyn won't make it through the night." I hopped the BART to Richmond with little more than the clothes on my back and my pathetically near-empty wallet. Almost 2 hours later, I arrived home. Too late. Evelyn had passed away before I could say goodbye. Professors wanted me to come back to class, to take the final, to graduate. I listened to exactly 3 out of 22 voicemails. Molly. Hillary, what the hell happened to you? Just call me. And then, Hillary, you have one final. That's it. Please don't throw it all away. Call me. We'll make arrangements for you. That was Dr. Gupta, her delicate accent floating through the line, comforting only in its familiarity. I almost called her back, the one person who seemed to have some empathy, who had always been a presence for me, an ear. I sat with my finger on the button thinking, but eventually hit delete.
Hillary, if you don't come back this week and take your final exam, you will not earn your degree. This is the last time I'm calling you.
Dr. Peterman. Asshole prick. I deleted them all. It all felt so hopeless. I couldn't scrabble for money from within the walnut walls of an exam hall, especially since if I had any hopes of passing, I'd need to study. I had 2 weeks left to bury Evelyn before the state intervened. But I had no real way of getting my hands on any money. I tried to apply for a credit card, but with no history, I'd been denied. I went to see Evelyn's estate lawyer, a thin, rumpled sort of man who operated from his damp basement in Elmwood, and he'd laughed at me. There was nothing but debt. I had to pay the debt before I could pay for Evelyn. I was stuck in this quasi-purgatory, hopeless and bottomless. The self-loathing felt like a thick, wet blanket. The haze of alcohol dulled the sharp edges, just a little.
"Here's what will happen," he explained to me, his twitchy fingers ashing a cigarette so frequently, so nervously he lost the cherry more than once and had to relight. "The state will do what's called a state-funded burial. It's not actually a burial. They'll cremate the body. You have time after that to claim the ashes, but then you owe the funeral home fees as well as the state. Then they dispose of the ashes how they see fit."
A wave of intense nausea overtook me. "Dispose?" I squeaked, breathing through my mouth. His breath smelled like fish.
"I don't know the protocols. The funeral homes generally have individual protocols."
I left him in his office, the ashtray tilted up to his face, chasing the red-hot ember around the glass with a broken camel between his teeth. Mick came back to Max's a week later, throwing a dirt-streaked manila envelope in front of me thick with bills. I sat in the same chair with the same drink, the same shoes, the same hatred on my tongue.
"There's a thousand there. I'll get more. How much time do we have?"
4 weeks from the day she died. So that's only two more. I flipped the envelope back and forth between my index and middle fingers. "Don't even bother." He sat on the stool next to me.
"I failed, Evelyn, a lot. I failed you."
"You don't owe me shit, Mick." I needed to stave off some kind of misplaced daddy syndrome which churned my stomach. He ordered a whiskey, then another. He clasped my shoulder and the gesture seemed almost paternal, caring. He bought me another drink. I felt the tear work its way down my cheek, splashing on the bar top, and under his thumb he slid the white pill across the bar top. It didn't feel like exploitation. It felt like friendship. It melted on my tongue, acrid and bitter, and when I closed my eyes, I floated. That night, Mick took me home, left me in Evelyn's apartment, a three-story walk-up on Market with peeling paint and a useless front lock. I slept on her bed, in her nightgown. When I woke up the next morning, I didn't feel bad. No real hangover, just the faded memory of happiness. It wasn't a high like I'd ever known. Back in college, we'd tested E, a warm liquidy pooling between my thighs and a bursting in my chest like we were in love with the whole world. This time, there were no hallucinations, no real elation, just a light-hearted easiness that I hadn't felt in months. I wanted it back. It tugged at me like physical craving, but as innocuous as caffeine. I hung out at Max's every day after that, waiting for Mick, but telling myself otherwise. I'd turn and look at the door every time it opened. Truth be told, I was starting to like the smell of the place. Evelyn's apartment smelled like expired Calvin Klein. When he came back, the envelope in his hand was thin. He tossed it down and sat with a grumbled sigh. He ordered us drinks without asking.
"You're not taking care of yourself, Hillary."
I knew I looked like hell. I didn't know what to say. I was falling apart. I wondered how many of those little white pills I'd need to stay oblivious forever. I hadn't washed my hair in more than a week, and it shone wet with grease. I wore the same pair of jeans because everything else fell off. Evelyn didn't have a washer, so I'd worn them in the shower, scrubbing shampoo into them with my fingernails and hanging them over the curtain rod to dry. The landlord had started coming around, knocking. He hadn't heard Evelyn died, but he still needed his rent, cancer or not. I had begun sneaking in and out, looking furtively up and down the hall before darting down the steps and into the street. The bills were stacking up. This time, he put the pill on the cocktail napkin. I almost didn't see it. What if I...